my alter ego in a Peruvian carnival costume. And so this is joint work with Thomas Wittig, who is not in costume, so this is actually him. And you can find our work on the archive right here. Okay. So, well, I'm not going to talk about uncertainty or non-locality or anything like this time, actually. But I'm just going to talk about the small effect, which occurs in quantum versus the classical setting, which I don't actually quite understand, but I'm rather intrigued about. So I hope that you will go out and tell me how it works in general and help me understand this effect. So, well, it's the end of the afternoon, so let me maybe start with a small story to introduce the problem, okay? So here we have our usual protagonist, Bob. He's in quite a tight spot. Let's imagine that, for example, he's been taking a philosophy class during the term, but he's been way too busy to attend any classes or even read the book. Maybe he's been busy creating key, who knows. So when it comes to the test, he quickly scrambles together some cheat sheet, maybe with the help of his friend Alice, and enters the test, okay? So, let's imagine that, well, I mean, he evidently didn't have enough time to prepare. He's quite ignorant. He has ignorance about the whole, okay? So let's say that there's just two pages in a book. So let's label the first page Y0 and the second page Y1. So he has ignorance about the whole in the sense that given his cheat sheet, unfortunately for him, it's hard for him to guess all of the answers, okay? So it's hard for him to guess Y0 and Y1. So the question that I will be obsessed with here all the time is that given that Bob has ignorance about the whole, can we kind of point to a part, so either to say the first or the second page, that he's ignorant about as well, okay? Thereby revealing, if you wish, the source of his ignorance, okay? So it's hard for him to guess everything, so let's challenge him and to a part that he for sure also cannot guess very well. So indeed. So quite often on the slide, I will have some memory. So this is a cheat sheet that Bob has at his disposal. It could be classical or quantum. And just maybe to restate it, so this is the question, the central question. Does Bob's ignorance about the whole implies that we can point to a part that he's ignorant about? Okay. So what do you think? Okay, well, there's no reply, I guess. Yes? Okay. Well, indeed, that's what I thought. but of course, I mean, you're probably all silent because I'm being kind of unfair. I have not quite given you yet enough information. How are we going to quantify ignorance and so on, okay? So let me do this now, okay? So what am I going to do? Well, first of all, let's be a bit more formal and say what I actually mean by ignorance. Then I will return to my problem. Like I said, I will be obsessing with this question. And this time, I will look at it a bit more formally. Then I will say what happens in the classical case or in contextual setting. And then, well, as you might have suspected, we will turn to quantum mechanics. Okay? And in the end, I'll have some open questions. I guess this is always the most interesting part, especially what happens for general theories. Okay. So let's start with how to quantify ignorance. Okay, so again, we have a whole. Oops. And I'll just take this to be two elements. So you can think of this all the time as two pages in a book, Y0 and Y1. So they are chosen with some probability distribution from, well, say these are just over a d-dimensional alphabet. I don't know. Maybe in Bob's philosophy class, he's completely ignorant, so they're uniformly at random. Then Bob has some memory about it. So depending on what Y0 and Y1 actually are, yes, you can think of this as Bob having some kind of encoding of Y0 and Y1. Okay? So maybe it's a quantum state or a classical state or some state in some general model. So, well, the joint state between, say, the book register containing Y0 and Y1 and this memory E, well, it just looks like this in the quantum setting. Okay? I'm just writing it out explicitly to make things clear. So here we have Y0 and Y1. Say, let's pick a d-dimensional alphabet for both of them. So this is the book register, and this is the encoding register. Okay. So now let's quantify ignorance, okay? And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to quantify ignorance in terms of the mean entropy. So you've already seen this morning in the talk by Renato. So sometimes you also write min here. I have infinity for the Rényi entropy of order infinity, but it's the same thing. Okay? So this quantity is kind of nice in the sense that it was shown to have some kind of operational interpretation. Namely, it's just minus the log of the probability that Bob manages to guess both y0 and y1, given access to his encoding E, maximized over all possible measurements he might make on that system. Okay? So this is how it looks like in the quantum case, but you can define it analogously in this operational way in any other theory that you might imagine. Well, I guess assuming you have sufficiently many measurements and so on. So, I mean, just to be perfectly clear, so maximizing over all measurements, so we just maximize over POVM, so these are positive operators, they sum up to the identity. Here we average, so this is the average success probability. And well, this is just the probability that given an encoding of y0 and y1, we actually manage to produce the right log. Okay, well, I guess it's hopefully clear we're going to quantify ignorance. Okay. So when I say just informally that Bob is ignorant about something, I just mean that this quantity here is big, so this min entropy is large, or equivalently, the success probability of guessing y0 and y1 is small. Okay. So now that we can quantify ignorance, let's look at the problem again a bit more formally. Okay. So again, I mean, this is just the picture we just had. We have y0 and y1, and we have some encoding thereof. So one might first wonder, like, how does our knowledge or ignorance about the whole actually relate to the ignorance of the parts, okay? So how does our ignorance of the whole, well, now measured in terms of this min entropy, relate to the ignorance about the part, so this is just a part, either y0 or y1. So this C here, you can think that I will later use it to point to the one that we actually have ignorance about. Okay, so let me make this a bit more precise. So we could imagine that depending on Bob's cheat sheet, I mean, of course, we are kind of adversarial, and we want to challenge him to actually reveal the source of his ignorance by pointing to the one page that he actually has not managed to learn. Okay. So somehow correlated with this memory, E. Oops. Sorry about this. Somehow correlated with this memory E, there's some pointer variable C that points to the one we are ignorant about. Okay. So our question, I mean, stated in terms of the min entropy, somewhat more formally, has the following form. So given that we have large ignorance, so high min entropy, can we determine a pointer C such that we have large ignorance about the part? Okay. So let me say a little bit about this pointer because it's kind of subtle and I will dwell on this pointer for a while actually. Okay. So we want this pointer to be consistent with the actual situation. Okay. So when I say that I want to have a consistent pointer C to the unknown, I mean that actually, so if I include my pointer register, so to say, C, to the total state, if I trace it out, I'm back to the original situation. So you may be wondering, this may seem kind of obscure, but what it means is that by introducing this pointer, I'm not allowed to alter the original situation. In particular, for example, I'm not allowed to destroy Bob's memory device, in which case, for sure, he's going to have large ignorance. This is kind of what this condition captures. Okay. So as I said, let's have a look what happens in the classical or in the non-contextual case. Okay. Well, so as you may have suspected, classically usually our intuition works. It's indeed true that classically ignorance about the whole does imply that I can point to some part that I'm ignorant about. Okay? So I can identify, if you wish, the source of my ignorance. Okay? Or in other words, there exists some consistent state, so some pointer, such that my knowledge about one of these parts is roughly at least as large, or my ignorance about one of the parts is roughly at least half as large as my ignorance about the whole. Okay? So in other words, if this here is pretty big, then my ignorance about one of the parts will also be quite large. So this has been proven classically in a cryptographic setting, where this is a useful inequality, by Jürg Ruhlschläger in 2007. You can also extend it, I mean, it's almost a classical case, I guess, to non-contextual local hidden variable models which are deterministic in the sense that my preparation can be, well, distributions over hidden variables, but the measurements I make are deterministic on them, have deterministic effects. So there's one more thing I want to say about this in the classical case. Okay. Namely that classically this inequality is also somewhat robust in the following sense. Okay. So let's imagine that we are back in this test scenario and Bob, using this little cheat sheet, is trying to do a test. But Alice actually somehow, during the exam, hands him a little note that contains m bits of extra information. Well, so even when we leak or give away some extra bits of information, ignorance about the whole still implies pretty large ignorance about one of the parts, as long as M is not too big. Okay? So I'm not going to prove this. It uses some properties of the mean entropy, which are actually quite intuitive and also hold for more general models. But, I mean, I'm happy to tell you more about this later. And so actually, one more thing maybe. I mean, this is some kind of official talk, but if you have questions during the talk, you don't need to wait until the end for this procedure. Okay. So this inequality here, which I refer to as the splitting inequality, so it's the mean entropy about the whole split over the parts, so to say, I will give you an example that shows that it can actually be violated arbitrarily in quantum mechanics. So violated arbitrarily means that, well, this here could be huge. Actually, we can make it pretty much as large as we want in my example. But this here is roughly one for any such extensions. But before I'm going to do this, like I said, I will dwell a bit more about the role of this pointer C, okay? Because it's somewhat subtle, but it's quite important to understand its role. So it can be, even classically, that my ignorance about the whole is very large, but yet I might know a lot about Y0 and Y1 individually. Okay. So let's just distinguish this case from the case that I actually want to discuss here. And I want to do this with the help of some example. Okay. So let's say that Y0 and Y1, well, we choose them from some d-dimensional alphabet. So this time I started from zero, but I guess it doesn't matter. And let's just choose them uniformly at random. Now, I want to give you a classical encoding, which will make these here small, but this one large. Okay, so how am I going to do this? Well, it's a probabilistic encoding, okay? So I'm going to flip a coin. And with probability half, I'm just going to give you Y0. And with probability half, I'm going to give you Y1. Now, well, it's somewhat clear that you will have large ignorance about the whole because here you have two d-dimensional elements, so to say, but I only gave you one d-dimensional system, okay? And indeed, I mean, this is roughly log d, okay? I mean, you can kind of also intuitively see this here. Well, I give you always exactly one of them. So there must be about log d bits of entropy. But so let's see what happens, sort of on average, when we want to guess them, okay? And so we can actually guess them pretty well if, on average, if we just do the following. So if I want to recover y0, I'm just going to output this classical encoding as is and say, well, this is my guess. So with probability half, I'm actually in good shape. It's indeed true. It's my guess. Okay? With probability half, well, I had bad luck, but there's some small probability that it matches the right value anyway. Okay? But anyway, so as d gets large, I'm close to a half. So remember again that the mean entropy is just minus the log of this. So this is roughly 1. So this is not very surprising. I mean, this can definitely happen. But let's see what happens. Can we point to some part that we're actually ignorant about, correlated with our encoding? And well, indeed, in each case, we can indeed do this. Okay. So here, up here, say we're in this case where I just gave you y0, well, for sure, you're not going to be able to guess y1. Okay? And also down here, if I give you y1, well, I can certainly point to a part that you don't know anything about, namely it's y0. So I just want to make this important distinction, or why this pointer C actually is important in this problem. Okay. So, well, as I said, we will see that it's not true in quantum mechanics. Okay. And so I kind of want to show you an explicit example that shows that it's not true. And I will do this kind of in a series of steps. Okay. So first we'll construct a specific encoding. Actually, it's an extension of something that you're all familiar with. After this, well, I want to show that we have ignorance about the whole to be able to pose our question at all. Then I will do some intermediate step, namely I'll form a random access encoding. You may remember this from Jonathan's talk. And finally, I will talk about this pointer C. Okay, and then we're done. Okay, so let's see how we might construct an encoding. So again, in my example, I want to consider these to be just elements of some d-dimensional alphabet. And I'll pick them uniformly at random. So the encoding that I'm going to give you of y0 and y1 has the following form. It's just a pure state. And in fact, it's just a rotated version of some specific starting state. Okay? So depending on what my input is, I'm going to rotate it. So x and z, here are the generalized Pauli matrices in dimension d. And wait. So if, depending on my y1, I'm going to apply z, and depending on my y0, I'm going to apply x. So as you, maybe just to emphasize, as you may notice, we are again, just in my classical example a little time ago, in the case where I have two d-dimensional things, so y0 and y1, but I encode them in a quantum system, this time, of dimension that has of dimension d. Okay, and maybe, oops. I will just put the starting state here. If you want to know, I guess you don't really need to worry about this normalization factor. But it's just a superposition of some specific starting state, and its Fourier transform. Okay, so this is just some eigenstate actually of z, and this is its Fourier transform. This may seem a little obscure, but let me make an example that probably most of you have seen before, which is exactly of this form. Okay. So let's say, for simplicity, that we are just in dimension 2. Okay. So we have just, so y0 and y1 are just bits. Okay. So I want to encode 2 bits into 1 qubit. Okay. So one way of doing this, which constitutes a random access encoding. So remember that the random access encoding is an encoding of some classical string into some quantum state such that I can retrieve any bit of my choosing, but maybe not all of them, with some reasonable probability. And so actually for encoding 2 classical bits into 1 qubit, chosen uniformly at random, there's an optimal quantum random access encoding, which is exactly this one for dimension 2. So if my bits are both 0, I just pick the starting state. So this here is in the middle. So this here is an eigenstate of z, and this one of x. So I'm just up here. Now, if my first bit is 1, I apply x. So I just reflect around the x-axis. If my second bit is a 1, I apply z. So I end up down here. And otherwise, if both bits are 1, then I'm down here. Okay. So I guess you've all seen this before. So this is just a special case of this encoding in dimension 2. Okay. So we've now considered a specific encoding. So let's convince ourselves that we actually have large ignorance about the whole. Okay. So this is just to remind you up here. Well, we have uniform, we have this particular encoding. So I don't actually want to show this, I'm just going to claim and then show you how it works for my example, that the following holds, okay? So again, maybe to abstract away a bit from these equations, clearly already by Holewo's theorem, I know that I must have some ignorance about the whole, because again, I'm in a setting where I try to take two d-dimensional elements, y0 and y1, and I'm stuffing them into just a single d-dimensional system, okay? So something must be lost. But this is just making sort of more precise how much exactly we lose here. So, I mean, to write this guessing probability, already a long time ago, these people have written it in a convenient form that makes it clear that you can solve it using a semi-definite program, okay? It's using an SDP. So I'm not going to look at what this SDP looks like and how we actually solve it. But one can show that the probability that I guess both y0 and y1 from this encoding is just 1 over the dimension. Okay? So again, if I take minus the log of this, I just get log d bits of mean entropy. And I'm claiming that the measurement that does this just has the following form. Okay? So actually, all the measurement operators are really just proportional to the states that we used in our encoding. So let's see how this works in our example. Okay. So in the example of dimension 2, the states that I had used to encode, remember, are just here, the points of this corner. And here in blue are the directions that I'm measuring. So actually in dimension 2, you can also think about this measurement as, well, I'm going to guess the parity, and then I'm going to measure either here or there. Okay. And I mean, you can see, maybe just to see, get some feeling for why this should behave like that. If I guess the parity, well, what happens? Well, I get it right. Then I'm indeed in good shape. I'll get the entire string. This happens with probability half. If I don't get it, well, then I'm in really bad shape, okay? Because then I will have an error on both bits. Okay. So I want to now make an intermediate step. Okay. So like I said, in dimension 2, actually this encoding that we have constitutes a random access encoding. And let's see what happens if we just consider a random access encoding. So when I do a random access encoding, I don't care about this pointer C. Okay. I just care about how well can I retrieve y0 and how well can I retrieve y1. I don't care about anything else. Okay. So what happens there? So again, one can write the guessing probability as an SDP. And if you do this, then you can show that, in fact, the optimum guessing probability just behaves like this. Okay. And the optimal measurements that achieve this, actually, and this is kind of why this step is interesting and useful, they are just measurements in the eigenbasis of z and x. Okay. So I measure z if I want to retrieve the first element, and x if I want to retrieve the second element. So let's see how this works in our example, where it's kind of clear that you would measure in these directions. So let's look at the example here, and let's say that I want to learn what is the first bit. Okay. So over here, I have a 0 in the first bit, and also over there. And here I have a 1 as the first bit. So I basically want to know, well, am I on this side, on the right-hand side, or am I on the left-hand side? Okay, so I measure z. Now, I might also want to retrieve the second bit, in which case, well, you can see, so here the second bit is 0, here the second bit is 0, here the second bit is 1, also 1. So I want to know, well, am I here, up here, or am I down there? Okay, so I measure in the x direction. Of course, it's higher dimension, it's somewhat more annoying to see this, but essentially it's kind of the same idea. So if you want, you can also think about actually this encoding that we've constructed as some random access encoding of two d-dimensional strings into one d-dimensional quantum system. Okay? But like I said, let's think back about what I said about this pointer C. This is not really what is so surprising here, okay? So classically, I had some encoding where I could do, well, pretty good as well, except that I have this square root here now, and previously I didn't have the square root, okay? Oops. So let's make an observation about the decoding measurements, though, okay? So I said that we measure in the Z or the X eigenbasis. Now, this works out well to retrieve these individual bits, but there's one more useful thing that we're going to use. Okay? Namely, if I look at what is the overlap of some element in the Z eigenbasis with this state, well, it behaves like this for all y0 and y1. And, well, if I look at what is the overlap with some element in the Fourier basis with this state, well, it also looks like this, and it's the same for all y0 and y1. So what this means is that for any other distribution over the strings, so not necessarily the uniform one, so this is why I put a prime here to remind you that it's not uniform, my guessing probability would have been at least as good using the measurements Z and X. Of course, there may be more better measurements in this case, I don't know, but using Z and X, I can do at least this well. So let's now talk about this pointer C. Okay. So let's remind ourselves what was our goal in the beginning. Namely, we want to show that for any consistent state, rho y0, y1, ec, so remember that consistent meant that if we trace out C, we are back to the original situation. We have that for any value this can take, this here is small. Okay, so this would constitute a violation of this inequality. So I'm claiming, and actually it's not so hard to see this, that for any C, so for any classical extension and for any C that value this takes, this state here just has the following form. So it looks very similar to what we had before, except here we now have some other probability distribution. Okay, that may, of course, depend on C. So just to give you some flavor why this is true, so there's two things that play into this that give you this. First of them is the consistency concision, so we want the reduced state to be the same. And the other one is the fact that we actually had pure states encodings here. Okay. So these two things together give you that it looks like this. Okay. Well, it's the end of the afternoon, so I don't know how much you're following this, but as we had already observed, using these measurements in the X and the Z bases for any distribution over the strings, we could do at least this well. Maybe even better, but at least this well. But that means that in particular for any distribution here, we can also do this well. So this means that for any extension, and in fact for any C, this here is roughly a half, roughly 1 for large d, okay? Okay. Well, I'm doing pretty well with time, actually. Okay. So let's just summarize what we've observed here, okay? So we've seen that classically, for any classical encodings E, I can find some consistent state, y0, y1, e, and pointer variable C, such that my ignorance about the part, namely labeled by C, is at least this big. Okay? So in other words, if I have large ignorance about the whole, I have pretty big ignorance about one of the parts. So maybe if you think back, for example, about this example, this in my example earlier, this was log D, and then this means that this is about half log D. Now, quantumly, we've seen that there indeed exists an example, like a specific encoding, where I have large ignorance about the whole. And I mean, we can make our example for any D, well, at least finite D, maybe also infinite D, but I don't want to claim that. Where I have large ignorance about the whole, okay? So I can make this huge. However, we've seen that for any consistent state, and in fact for any value, this is roughly 1, as D is large, okay? So the difference here I'm comparing log D to 1, and here I'm comparing log D to, well, log D over 2. Okay. So to summarize, I mean, classically, ignorance about the whole really means that I have significant ignorance about at least one of the parts, okay? This is indeed intuitively what one, I guess, at least I would expect. And, I mean, maybe to emphasize again, this is true even in a sort of helpful setting where someone gives you n bits of extra information, okay? By whatever means. I mean, in my example, again, indeed, you could think about L is passing some other message to Bob with m helpful bits, or maybe in some model you can think that you have some kind of helpful hidden variable model that maybe leaks a bit of extra information that you don't have control over. However, quantumly, ignorance about the whole does not imply ignorance about any of the two parts. Okay? So indeed, like I said, I'm quite intrigued by this. And I'm hoping that one can understand this a bit more fully. So let me talk for a while about open questions. Like I said, they are most interesting, and they may make you sweat, like Bob here. So one may, of course, wonder, like, why does this effect occur? So what is actually the source of this effect? Okay. I mean, intuitively, it's related to other notions like complementarity, for example, which, and I'm stating it here extremely informally, often stated in sentences of the form, well, we may learn a lot about individual properties, so here the parts, y0 and y1, but not all of y0 and y1 at once, okay? So, well, I can learn individual things, but I cannot learn everything, and that's indeed surprising. But if you think about it, at least probabilistically, that's maybe not so surprising as you might think, because even classically, it can be sort of true. Probabilistically. Okay. So if you think back about my example, we had some encoding of these d-dimensional strings into some classical encoding E, probabilistically, for which my success probability was this big. Now, in my quantum example, we could do a bit better. Okay. So we moved from like d to square root d over here, but it's maybe not very impressive, okay? So, I mean, what really intrigues me here is really that there's another thing that distinguishes these two situations, which does nothing have to do with these success probabilities, but rather it has something to do with what's not there. Like, can I point to something which you don't know anything about? Okay. Well, like I said, so I would like to understand more fully where does this effect truly come from. Can you sort of identify it in some general models? So indeed, I've already been talking about this. Can you understand this more abstractly? When does this happen? When does it not happen? I mean, is it enough to be contextual? I guess so. How does it work for really most general non-contextual models? And what I think is also an interesting question, I mean, maybe less interesting than the previous ones, is what is the maximum violation that I can achieve in fixed dimension? Okay, so let's fix the dimension. What is the largest violation I can achieve? Or is this one actually maybe already optimal? Which seems reasonable, okay? So this inequality you've already seen at the end of Jonathan's talk. So, I mean, you might think about this as a more robust version of some complementarity, maybe. I don't fully understand it yet. So you kind of want to know, well, what is the biggest gap that I can have here, okay? So here we can have about log d in the quantum case in dimension d, using a d-dimensional encoding. Seems pretty close to optimal, given that I can never make this here bigger than d, this quantity here. But is it really true? Then there's something that intrigues me, because you might, of course, say, well, there's this effect that we may or may not fully understand. Can I actually go and verify that it's there? Okay. So this is somewhat tricky, because as you may have suspected, I want to show that there's something which I want to prove to you somehow in some experiment that there's something is not there, okay? which seems somewhat harder than proving something is there. Okay? So one would kind of need to show that for any C, my guessing probability is indeed low. Okay? Of course, I could go to some lab, or well, I probably cannot. That would be a bad idea. But someone more knowledgeable than me could go to the lab and do some experiment using these d-dimensional states. Okay? But then, well, you would observe that the guessing probability maybe scales like a half plus a half divided by square root of d. Okay. But as we said, this is not really what is surprising here. Okay, it's not surprising to me, at least. So just exhibiting the fact that there's some d-dimensional random access encoding seems too weak. I mean, there's maybe just one thing I want to say about this, is that this inequality, even though it may seem a bit obscure, does have some advantages of being robust in the sense that even if Alice is sort of later trying to help Bob a bit, leaking some extra information, you can still observe this effect as long as these extra bits are not too small. Actually, because you can scale up our example for any d, you can also say, well, for any m bits that Alice could later communicate to Bob, I can still find an example by just making d large enough, where the difference between this classical and this quantum setting is big. Oh, well, that's all I wanted to say for now.
Thanks very much, Stephanie, for this nice talk. We have time for some questions.
So you just at the very end asked, you know, how do we understand this effect? It's not just the quadratic difference. It's about what we don't know. It seems to me it may be useful to think about it in terms of the gap that arises between quantum and classical random access coding when your figure of merit is not average probability of success, but worst case probability of success. Yeah, because then in the classical case, you only have probability half, and in the quantum case.
Yeah. No, I agree, yeah, indeed. I mean, yeah, maybe that's a good idea, because indeed, as you observe, like X and Z are always still good. Whereas classically, of course, it depends on the distribution. But I haven't thought about it. I mean, I'm happy to discuss it.
So I think there are also negative results on how good are the random access code that you can build in a quantum world. So do they translate into some upper bound on how large can be the violation of the inequality that you gave?
Maybe. So like I said, I think actually this one is actually very close to optimal in dimension D because I can never make the min entropy about Y0 and, I mean, let me put it this way. I'm not sure, okay? I would think that for any pure state random access encoding, which is sufficiently symmetric, you could see such an effect. However, whether for any encoding that exhibits such an effect, you would necessarily get a useful random access encoding, I'm not so sure. Well, it depends, I guess, what you care about in the random access encoding. Typically, in a random access encoding, you try to construct it in such a way that where at least all existing constructions kind of are equally good for all the bits, which is the case in the symmetric one, but which maybe doesn't happen in other encodings of this form. But OK, you could say in my random access encoding, I also don't care about this.
This reminds me of one of the earliest examples of a quantum information strange phenomenon, Wiesner's multiplexing channel, where basically you would encode two messages, one in the rectilinear basis and one in the diagonal basis, with enough error correction to be able to recover. You would actually mix them, mix the two messages together, alternating bits from one to the other. Mm-hmm. And so this would mean that you could recover either message reliably, but you couldn't recover both. So I guess you can call that a kind of random access code.
Yeah.
But he observed in this in his original paper that it was insecure in principle.
I see.
I'm wondering what the relation to that is, or to information locking, which is.
So I don't know about locking. I would have to think about it. But there is indeed a relation to some of the things that Wiesner has been doing, and because. So where the splitting inequality, so to say, let's go back to it. Where this one is useful, if E is classical, is in protocols that aim to do oblivious transfer, which I guess was somewhat under a different name proposed also in this paper by Wiesner in some form. And there you want to show, if I indeed have ignorance about the whole, and I can identify one that you don't know. Whereas with respect to quantum information, this is not quite true anymore. So I think there's definitely a relation between this and what Wiesner was doing. I don't remember, actually. Let me put it this way. Even in this case, you can still do OT if this one is not, if in some different way. You just have to be a bit more smarter about it. So I'm not quite sure where this relation is tight. But that's cool. So I hadn't read this paper for a while, actually. So I should look at it again.
So just to be a bit a bit more precise about history, what Charlie was referring to as multiplexing channel is the term that Wiesner coined back in the late 60s or the early 70s when he invented oblivious transfer. So this multiplexing channel of Wiesner is nothing else than one out of the oblivious transfer, invented in 1970 by Wiesner.
Yeah.
However, the encoding that you showed corresponds not to the original Wiesner solution in his paper, conjugate coding, but to Breitbart's improvement to it. But really, this encoding that you showed is exactly Breitbart's version of Wiesner's multiplexing,
okay.
i.e. Oblivious transfer.
Yeah, I guess I could have said this, it's been some time, actually, that I looked at these papers. But this basis in between, I guess you also call it somewhat a Breitbart basis, or some people call it like that. I don't know whether it's a common name. This one. Maybe that comes from, I guess, yeah. Okay, I see. Okay.
Sorry. Not only is this a Breitbart basis for one qubit, but the encoding of using X and Z, each one of them for each slice, for each qubit,
mm-hmm.
doing one and or the other depending on the corresponding bit in the two classical strings.
Okay, yeah.
That's precisely Breitbart's improvement on Wiesner's original oblivious transfer.
Okay, I see. Okay. Oh, that's cool.
Okay, are there any more questions? If not, let's thank Stephanie and all the speakers.